playing this game, I was really frustrated at how much power the opposition had and how little they had to do. Mm-hmm. And so I walk away from this with a brand new appreciation for the difficulty of ratifying a federal amendment. My name is Lisa Tatro, and I am a historian of American democracy.
Welcome to Subject Matter Tabletop,
the podcast about board games and the subject matter that animates them. I am Jordan Tynes.
And I'm Steve Gonsler. We're joined today by Lisa Tatro, who is an associate professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Subject Matter Tabletop, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining us.
I am genuinely thrilled to be here.
We're here today to play a game that Subject Matter Tabletop's had its eyes on actually for quite a while.
Since it was initially announced,
yeah,
and is being developed.
And
yeah.
Since we kind of generated the idea, the premise for this show or this podcast, it was one of the games that was immediately apparent to us that it would be a good candidate for the format. And that game is called Votes for Women. And it's about the passage of the 19th Amendment and the movement for women's suffrage. We should say also that it was designed by Tory Brown. And developed by Kevin Bertram and Fort Circle Games. The folks at Fort Circle Games were kind enough actually to provide us with a copy of this game. So they had seen the show and saw what we were up to. And they also—
Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening.
They also recognized that this would be a good fit. So they sent us a copy, which was very kind of them.
Welcome. And what do we need to know about you right off the bat?
I have my entire career been a student and a scholar of women's suffrage. I wrote a book called The Myth of Seneca Falls, mm-hmm. which was about the story behind the story of the origin, supposedly, of the movement,
right.
Situating them much later. I did a lot of speaking during the centennial and was part of the really robust community of scholars who were telling new and different stories about the centennial and trying to get us to repitch how we understand this movement. And also the event of the 19th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really curious, and I was encouraged to see in the preview materials that you shared with me that they are trying to incorporate some of that complexity into this game. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited to play it and see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also myself someone who loves board games and never gets to play them because I don't have a community of people who do play them. So I was also very excited merge two things that I like, although not with quite the same study that you two provide to them.
I'm so glad to give you an opportunity to play
Absolutely.
A game. Yeah. You gave a keynote address. You were involved with the Centennial Smithsonian exhibition,
yeah.
right?
Yep. So the talk that I gave, so they did the keynote at the opening of the Centennial exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery, the Smithsonian, at the invitation of another amazing suffrage scholar, Kate LeMay. And then after or around the keynote that I gave that day, we had a day of scholars being in the gallery and also giving talks amongst ourselves and communing and thinking and learning about each other's scholarship. Mm-hmm. So hopefully today we can bring some of the names of those amazing suffrage scholars into the
Absolutely.
Game. And
citation is important.
Attribution, for sure. But I thought often when we were first trying to find somebody for this game, right? I found that exhibit quite quickly when I was
Doing,
I was like, oh, this looks amazing. I didn't see this when it was up. And I thought this game should have been in the exhibit, but it wasn't out yet. It didn't exist. It seemed like the perfect object for that kind of showcase.
The thing about that exhibit as well is that because of their schedule at the National Portrait Gallery, they had to run it quite early. So it opened in March, or it opened in early 2019, and then it was going to close kind of before the end of the centennial, which at the time we were all like, oh, it's too bad that it's so early. And then it turned out that it was wonderful because the pandemic hit, and it turned out to be one of the few times that we were all able to get together.
Wow,
and it ended up being also because it published books, it published a book along with it with scholarly essays, lots of great images from the exhibit. It ended up being this event that was somewhat key to the overall memory of the centennial itself and of much of our scholarly experience. So Kate LeMay became much loved and herself a really astounding suffrage scholar.
So the centennial, of course, is a big landmark, right? A hundred years of this. What is it that you think is most important about for us to look at when we're thinking about this, the history of suffrage movement and the right for women to contribute to the democratic process in the United States by the act of voting. I mean, it's abstracted in a sense in this game. It's abstracted in a lot of the conversations we have about it, in the documents that we're looking at, the books. But how, what can we kind of practically take away from that and learn and maybe use in today's political context?
So, of course, I'm going to have a really hard time narrowing it down to one, but I will for your sake.
But you can do a couple.
So I think the first is a point that was made over and over and over again during the centennial, that 1920 is neither when the amendment is ratified, neither the beginning of women voting nor the conclusion of the fight for all women's access to the ballot. So states control suffrage, not the Constitution. So many states had already voluntarily gotten rid of the criteria male for being a voter. There was a whole movement of people who were trying to get the states to remove it. There was another branch of the movement who thought, why do this state by state by state bit when you can just go to one citadel, the U.S. Congress, and win there? So by the time the 19th Amendment passes, only eight states don't have women voting in some capacity. So millions of women are voting before 1920.
But not in a kind of like... what's the word? Not quite universal. That's not the word I want. But like they could vote sometimes, but not always. There were like these conditional situations.
Well, it varied. Yeah. So there was full suffrage. In other words, women voted on exactly the same terms as men in almost all of the West. And also in New York, starting in 1917. Then there was something called partial suffrage, which is where women could vote in certain types of elections, like presidential, municipal, but not in all elections. So, for example, in Illinois in 1913, they passed municipal suffrage. So in that case, many women of color were voting in Illinois, and Ida B. Wells would have organized the Black women, and they managed to elect the first African-American alder person to the city of Chicago by organizing Black women's votes.
As early as 1913?
As early as 1913. Yeah, so it varied. And it was pretty much from Pennsylvania kind of down through Florida along that East Coast where women were not voting on any terms whatsoever.
I mean, that sounds complicated. Like, how did that all play out?
That is a long and varied story, and it played out in different ways in different places, right? So every state sort of had its own history of how and why they ended up lifting the word male. And just before we kind of explain, in some ways we don't have a full history of how and why in every state it got lifted. Unfortunately, one of the things that has commonly been used to explain it, and particularly a lot of the older scholarship, is that they finally didn't hate women. You know, there was a kind of like... there was a kind of willingness to suspend sexism. But that treats sexism as an independent variable. And in most of these situations, race and sex were very tightly tied. And so it may be something like in this same period when all of these states, particularly out west and then starting in the east, are lifting the word male or allowing people, women, to vote in certain types of elections, a simultaneous process is happening whereby they're putting in place all kinds of race restrictions. So there are literacy tests, poll taxes, not just in the Deep South or in the former Confederacy, but in many, many states. So it was also a process many people are starting to argue about whitening the electorate during this era. And so, and one of the things that happens when the 19th Amendment is passed, when I said millions of women were voting before and millions would not vote after, the 19th Amendment does not confer anything upon women. It polices the states. And it says to the states, you may not use the word male. So it says the United States, you know, may not restrict suffrage in the United States or any state on account of sex. So the few states that hadn't lifted the word male completely had to after the 19th Amendment. But because of that simultaneous process going on at exactly the same time of poll taxes, literacy tests, many women of color or even poor white women found themselves ensnared in those tests. So one barrier was now gone, but other barriers still existed in differential ways for women. So I think probably the second thing is, which women are we talking about, right? Because there's a kind of universal white middle-class woman that's posited when we talk about votes for women. And of course, that doesn't capture the experience of the vast majority of women in this nation.
So it's so fascinating to hear you talk about these historical topics. This game, I want to flag up a couple of things for us to consider right now. I don't want to give too much away before we get in and play. But some of what happens in this game, it takes place for those listening across a map of the United States. It's a board with a map, and each state has a space, and we will be vying for control of these spaces. So there's a kind of geography of struggle that plays out across the map of the United States, which I think is going to be interesting for us to explore together, given some of the context you just provided about the kind of patchwork of voting rights across the United States and patterns of suffrage and suppression. The other thing that stands out to me is the importance of this game takes place over, it's on the board here, between 1848 and 1920. So it's like antebellum to prohibition is the kind of sweep of time. And I'm curious to hear more from you. We can talk about this after we play if you want, but I would love to hear more about the role that the Civil War and Reconstruction plays in shaping and informing not just this struggle, but like the landscape of political struggle and electoral politics in the United States during this period in which this happens.
It's essential. I mean, you can't, unfortunately, this story has often been told as if it only evolves around gender, right? I talked about that before, about, you know, that there's some single variable that tells this story. And it's often been segregated from the history of black voting and the Civil War and race in America. And it is centrally connected and shot through all of that, which is much of what the Centennial Scholarship did. Well, so the American Civil War happens, blah, blah, blah. Two things happen. We are one nation at the end of it. And we are a nation without slavery. And so what is the status of 4 million newly freed people? Are they equal citizens? Are they, what is the code of laws that now governs them? Is it the same code of laws that governs white people? Is it a different code of laws? And that's a big debate at the beginning. And very quickly, the Southern states start creating a different code of laws. The U.S. Congress, which is still composed of a lot of radical abolitionists who will very quickly fade from the congressional scene, but they say, for example, that makes a mockery of our victory. You know, that's, why did we fight this war and end slavery if we're going to essentially just have a new code of laws that is not slavery in name, but slavery in fact? And these are the black codes and things like that. So very quickly, Congress takes control of the Reconstruction era from the president, who's willing to just let these Southern states back in on the same terms as, not necessarily the same, but similar terms to pre-war. Congress starts passing something called the Reconstruction Amendments, which is the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, as a way, among other things, to try to rebuild the Union on a new basis. The 14th Amendment is much of what the rights that we have today are based upon. So the equal protection of the laws. So it says African Americans born in the United States are citizens. And it says they should have equal protection under the laws. In other words, they will be subject to the same code of laws. And you can't deprive them of that, of their equal protection under the laws without due process. It says a bunch of other things, but those are the key pieces here. And then the 15th Amendment comes along and says, you may not discriminate in voting on the basis of race. It's the very first federal amendment to police the states around the question of voting. And it's the first time Congress has a debate about which Americans can vote, you know, or like who should be voting, because that's always been a state prerogative. And then the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery, except as punishment for a crime, which, of course, is a very important caveat for the history of mass incarceration. So those three amendments really create a brand new nation. Many people call this the Second Founding. In other words, the kind of creation of the modern legal apparatus that will govern America. The 15th Amendment is hugely important for all kinds of reasons. First being that there had been people demanding women's voting in the antebellum era, but nobody would have thought to do that through a federal amendment. Because this was a state prerogative, and no one had ever proposed using the federal government to police this. So the 15th Amendment creates the first opportunity for people to start thinking about regulating voting through the Constitution. And it's a big divide inside the people advocating votes for women. Is this constitutional or not to pursue another method like this? Or is this, was the 15th Amendment just a war measure?
Yeah, interesting. So there's this period in the second founding period in the United States history, which establishes a kind of constitutional framework that is used later or models a kind of path forward for recodifying certain boundaries around, I don't know, I would want to say like political subjects, but like, but you know, political agents or something like this, right? Yeah, that's interesting.
Seems like there's some lessons to be learned in what is happening today.
That is absolutely right. And so I would say the other key piece about the 15th Amendment, not only does it propose a new, you know, a new constitutional regime around the idea of suffrage, but it also brings in race into mm-hmm. the American electorate. Right now, tons of black men are voting, and it is, although the 15th Amendment only says you can't discriminate on the basis of race, because most states still have the word male in, that does not let women of color into the franchise at this era. A bunch of suffragists are really, really angry that sex isn't included in the 15th Amendment, and they break off and they do all kinds of highly racist things. And that's Stanton and Anthony. And then also the nation then, many, many white supremacists are, and many kind of ordinary Americans who have sort of unexamined racial bias are really angry that there are a bunch of black voters. And so in some ways, getting women's suffrage passed, so-called women's suffrage, is always tied up with the question of what is the composition of our electorate and how dissatisfied are we with it being biracial now and even multiracial, right? Because in some cases, this let in Hispanic men or... So that is a piece that is intimately tied with the 19th Amendment's advocacy and even the advocacy within the states, referencing our aforementioned discussion, right, about the kind of purifying and the whitening of the electorate that's going on simultaneously.
In the years since 1920, since the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and I imagine this is maybe just as true or more true of since the years since the 15th Amendment, but how important has it been not just for like redrawing who can vote, but actually for motivating and being something which like strategies for suppressing voting?
Hugely.
Yeah. So can you, could you say a little bit about that? Yeah. About the legacy of the 19th Amendment as something which inspired movements to suppress voter rights?
The 19th Amendment was in many ways a concession to not addressing the question of racial suppression that was going on at this time. There were versions of the amendment that people said, you know, this should also address the disenfranchisement of black men that had been going on since 1890 in a legal capacity. And the women of color will come to these major flagship white organizations, or at least white-led organizations, and say, we still can't vote. The fight goes on. And these organizations say, no, we declare victory. Our fight is won. So at the time, you could argue that the 19th Amendment itself was a compromise with and a willingness to abide by the whitening of the electorate that was going on at the time. It didn't challenge that. And in fact, it re-inscribed it. And secondly, you could argue that the 15th and the 19th Amendment, by not conferring suffrage upon individuals, but just policing the states on very limited grounds, has left open in perpetuity, not just since, you know, the poll taxes and literacy tests, but in perpetuity, the ability of the states to pop up new restrictions and create voter suppression. Yeah. So we have, for example, right now, voter ID laws, you know, all kinds of different things. And there were discussions during the 15th and the 19th Amendment about creating a federal right to vote that was invested in people, as opposed to the states appointing and creating voters. And that never happened. And the 19th Amendment was also a compromise with that, which is part of why we're still in the same mess we're in now. Social movements have consistently won, striking down offensive and discriminatory state behavior on a limited and focused basis, but left in place the ability of states to regulate and create voters. So what they've done is they haven't used that method anymore. So once they couldn't use race after the 15th Amendment, by the 1890s, they realized, oh, well, we can pop up literacy tests, we can pop up poll taxes, and then we can targetedly administer those. That history is still with us. That has never changed. And both the 15th and the 19th Amendments continued to allow for that method of governance. And there were people who demanded that we get rid of that kind of regime over voting, and we never have as a nation.
I am not surprised, unfortunately, to learn through talking with you already that there is a romanticization of the symbol of suffrage.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And that, I guess, leads me into this question of the mythology around it. And even in your work, you have that, you use that word, the myth of Seneca Falls. What is the myth of Seneca Falls?
So this board game starts in 1848. That is the date of Seneca Falls. And the traditional dating of this entire movement is generally 1848 to 1920. And the people even take this movement to stand in for feminism as a whole and call it first wave feminism, you know, which was all about getting the vote, all of which is nonsense. And so 1848 is the date in which this New York Women's Rights Convention takes place in Seneca Falls, New York. It is the first publicly advertised, you know, publicly held women's suffrage or women's rights convention that we've had in the United States. It is not at all the beginning of women's rights agitation or of women's rights demands. All that kind of stuff has been going on for quite a while. Nonetheless, 1848 and Seneca Falls becomes marked very quickly as the beginning of the movement, as a kind of sacred, inspiring date. Stanton and Anthony were, you know, the acclaimed leaders from 1808 forward, and they were the mothers of feminism, and everyone loved them. And 1848 is where the vote was born, and, you know, henceforth, all great feminist things flew and, you know, encountered much unfair opposition. And then in 1920, you know, they finally won, and it's a very triumphant and happy story. You know, the mothers, you know, fought the system and beat it. So the myth of Seneca Falls is kind of different than what we're talking about, but I wrote a book that's a history of where that story comes from. Rather than assuming that that moment and that interpretation of that moment were simultaneous, I started wondering, where did that interpretation of this moment come from? And I discovered that it comes from fights over the 15th Amendment and other things after the American Civil War. So it's a story that's created much later, but then becomes so successful in the post-war period, and it's created by Stanton and Anthony, so it's not it's not surprising that they are the ones who are benighted by this story. It's created by them, and they kind of read it back onto the beginning and start creating a beginning in the post-war movement to elevate and advocate for their own leadership at a time when they're very embattled.
Interesting. That's interesting. That's interesting. It's like an appeal to authenticity for their bid for leadership.
Yeah. I mean, all social movements use story, right? You have to use story. That's how we create meaning as people. And after the war, these two activists very skillfully use story to try to both shape the campaign and shape their position within it.
We're sitting in front of a game that is supposed to, I'd say, simulate the social movement around this time period we're talking about. What are your expectations of this game? What are your hesitations? What are you nervous about? What are you excited about?
I have been nervous since you proposed it about the oversimplification of the narrative, including the dates 1848 to 1920. But when you sent me the write-up that went with the game, I was impressed that the game creator also acknowledged the, much of the complexity around this and the ways in which race is shot through this story and much of the ways in which whiteness is at the heart of the amendment. So I'm really curious to see how that translates into this board game, and also how they're going to use, how they're going to situate 1920.
So you play board games. You enjoy games. Do you want to share with the listeners maybe a little bit of your background of play?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up before the internet, so I played a lot of games growing up. Really enjoyed it. I came come from a family of avid card players and lots of backgammon.
What kind of card games?
Well, my all the grown-ups in my life were avid bridge players, so I was drugged from bridge tournament to bridge tournament as a child. But mostly we played Gin Rummy and another game called Oh Hell, which I don't know.
Oh, I don't know that one. My grandmother was a very big and enthusiastic canasta player.
Yes, younger, so
used to play a lot of canasta with her. I don't think she plays much anymore.
But. Yeah, and we played a lot of backgammon growing up. And even when I would come home, the first thing my dad would do would be, sort of be to throw that backgammon board down on the table. And then I love board games, but I have live in communities that don't play them as robustly anymore. And because I love them and I miss them, your arrival has prompted a whole discussion about how me and my friends need to start playing games.
Love it.
So, awesome. Yeah.
Long may it continue.
All right, well, let's get started.
Votes for Women recreates the struggle for women's suffrage, stretching from the movement's mythical roots at Seneca Falls in 1848 up to the eventual state-by-state vote to ratify the amendment, or not, in 1920. This struggle unfolds vividly at the table, as suffragist players fight for change by staging parades, writing petitions, printing newspapers, or picketing the White House, while backlash from the opposition desperately tries to stem the tide of democratic reform. Votes for Women is a game about building a movement in the face of nearly impossible odds. The amendment's fate is contested through a mixture of careful hand management and area control, as players use decks of cards to help them shape the political disposition of the nation. Player decks are organized according to successive historical eras, changing the character and relative power of cards subtly as the game develops from turn to turn. In the early stages, the opposition's resources are immense, and their methods of political repression are often deliberately unfair. However, as the eras progress, the suffragists gain access to an increasingly diverse and versatile roster of activists, organizers, and tactics, which begin to open opportunities for leveling the playing field. Each game of Votes for Women consists of at least 6 turns. During each of these turns, players use hands of cards to vie for political control across a map of the United States, split into geographical regions such as the Plains or the Atlantic and Appalachia. Players can deploy their cards in one of 4 ways. First, cards can always be used for one of the 3 core actions: campaigning, organizing, and lobbying. Campaigning allows players to influence political sentiment in a given region on the board, helping secure ratification in the endgame and enabling them to claim powerful state cards, which offer single-use bonuses along the way. Organizing allows players to collect buttons. Buttons act as a form of political currency, which players can spend at the start of each round in a bid to claim strategy cards. These strategy cards can create game-changing swings in electoral influence, or enact persistent effects which alter the board state forever. Lobbying allows players a chance to successfully advance, or halt, the amendment's passage through the legislative process in Congress. Finally, players can forego these 3 core actions and choose instead to play their cards as an event. Card events add flavor to the game by recreating historical incidents or conjuring historical figures into play. As the balance of power shifts back and forth, this creates a tense game of cat and mouse as players debate when to commit cards to which type of actions so as to ensure that they both maximize their movement's resources and respond nimbly to the shifting needs of history. If by the end of the 6th turn, the suffragists fail to pass the 19th Amendment in Congress, the game immediately ends and the opposition wins. If the amendment is passed by Congress before the 6 turns are up, the game enters a new phase, final voting, where a sequence of rapid-fire votes are contested state by state to determine the results of ratification. If the amendment is successfully ratified, then the vote is won and the suffragists are victorious.
In this final phase, the arduous struggle of the preceding decades comes to a thrilling conclusion. This creates a nail-biting final chapter to the gameplay, which alters the character and feeling of the game during its second act. State by state, players take turns rolling dice to determine the fate of ratification across the United States. If the suffragists are able to secure the vote in at least 36 states, the amendment is ratified and victory is achieved. But if the opposition manages to defeat the amendment in just 13 states or more, then ratification fails. Crucially, actions taken throughout the game before final voting can alter dice rolls from one state to the next, making the game's finale unpredictable as the smallest of individual actors may end up swaying the fate of the nation. In some cases, this may make it more likely for the game to present historically accurate moments of drama, such as the famous Harry Byrne change of heart in Tennessee. Votes for Women makes the history of the 19th Amendment accessible to players in rich and engaging ways. The game implements an accessible rule set and employs lightweight mechanics such as hand management, dice rolling, and area control that should be very intuitive to first-time players. The game is simply teachable. At the same time, the deliberate asymmetry of its design establishes clear lessons about the democratic process. The decks are literally stacked in the favor of the opposition, especially at the outset. Finally, the supplemental historical materials immerse players in the period and offers avenues for further inquiry and exploration. The allure of these authentic reproductions draws players into the era and prompts us to dive right into new casual and potentially serious research rabbit holes. The box itself functions as a treasure chest of historical information.
Looking at all these red cubes that I have out here.
You feeling a little full of yourself?
I'm feeling.
Are you feeling
way
like you're really
awful than I
quite
felt yesterday
awesome?
At the start of the game? I was like, oh my god.
So he just removed one of our 6.
It's going to happen a lot.
You suck. So all of our advances in Congress have just been thoroughly reversed.
I'm going to play Backlash to the Movement. This is That was just quite an
Isn't that kind of basically been your entire modus operandi?
And then I'm going to use this as well, but I think...
Goodbye, Wisconsin. Goodbye, Ohio. Goodbye, Arizona. Goodbye, California. All right, come on, dice.
1-6.
We need 1-6. And we got it! Yay!
Why'd you roll 3?
And we've ratified. Okay, so how many states have we ratified in? Basically 5.
5, 6. Only 30 more to go.
The purple ones come back.
You have to split them across your 2.
No, I don't.
Okay, they're still arguing, so I'm going to say more about Sojourner Truth. I commend the game maker for not including anti-woman as a statement that Sojourner Truth made, because it seems as if she never, in fact, made that statement.
So you roll 3, just fill those up, and well, and then all we got to do is hope he doesn't roll a 4 in this turn.
Oh! Oh!
Holy
he
cow!
Rolled double 4s!
There it is.
Unbelievable.
Utah seals the deal for the opposition.
Wow. All right, game's over. Wow. We were 3 short.
We just finished playing Votes for Women.
It was exciting.
It was really exciting.
Much closer than I expected.
It was tense.
As ratification started, I thought we were doomed.
I was feeling pretty confident in the early doors. Then I lost my ability to lobby successfully in Congress, and all of a sudden ratification was going down.
Yeah.
And then I got a little scared. But I managed to rally towards the end, and I got 13 states to reject ratification, which is the win condition for the opposition.
Opposition won.
So the opposition defeated women's suffrage.
And you know, let's background this a little bit, foreground this a little bit with the idea that we were like pretty convinced that it's impossible for the suffragists to win.
Mm-hmm.
We our play test yesterday was like horribly lopsided.
Yeah.
And we may have been playing it poorly, but that's okay. And your students said it seems impossible for the suffragists to win.
Yeah.
And it really came down to a single die roll at the end of this game.
Yes, it did.
And that was
Although
that's amazing.
We were probably 2 die rolls away from winning. So I think, it did come down to a single die roll.
Tight margin.
Yeah. But I think it may have been 2. Turns away for us. So,
all right. So before we dig into some of the more specific things, what the first question we always like to ask people right after they've played a game that engages directly with their expertise is to reflect at like a very high level, what you think this game as a game is communicating to players coming from any manner of background about this historical topic.
Well, obviously first, just how incredibly difficult it was to get this thing through Congress and then ratified, which through 2 plays now has not successfully happened.
Right? Yeah, we're 0-2.
So I think it points to just how incredibly difficult it is to pass a constitutional amendment. Yeah.
Was it like, at the time, was it surprising that it was ratified? Like, were people
surprised
that it succeeded at all?
Yeah, I mean, it was a nail biter, as much time as ratification is. And they had to have some southern states where you see all of the intense opposition building from the very beginning of the game. And had they not gotten Tennessee by Harry Burns, change of heart, it would not have gone over. Yeah. Wow. So
well, that was sort of
it came down to not just one die, but like one guy deciding to change his vote.
Right.
Based on, something from his mother, and he decided after it was tied and therefore going to go down that he didn't want to be on the wrong side of history, and he changed his vote. So you think of like the hundreds of thousands of votes that had taken to get to the place where Harry Byrne gets to vote, and even then it's decided by one vote.
Wow.
It's not.
So, that's crazy. So for people at the time who were maybe not interested or not engaged or perhaps skeptical, they were just, that'll never happen. But then it actually did happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think, once you've got something out for ratification, you obviously have a kind of momentum that you want to try to capitalize on. But as we know with the ERA, you can very quickly turn back that momentum. So
do you think there's anything missing from this game? Like, as a historian of this subject, what are some of the things that stood out to you just like right off the bat as you were playing it that like there should be space in this design for this?
So I have not yet seen any representation of the 19th Amendment itself. I didn't see one during the game. I don't see one in the historical documents.
I think that one of the documents is
there's a really great bunch of historical documents, like reproductions of historical documents that come with the game. Oh yeah, they do. Okay, stand corrected. They have right here the 19th Amendment of like a historical facsimile of the thing that was signed to
the House Resolution.
Yeah, the House mm-hmm. Resolution. And let's read the 19th Amendment since it has been absent from the game. Yeah. Resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, 2/3 of each house concurring therein, that the following article is proposed as an amendment to the Constitution, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the Constitution when ratified by legislatures of 3/4 of the several states. And then we have the article. The right of the citizens of the United States to vote. Let's just stop right there.
Okay.
There is no such right. I mean, there is in our imagination. There is in animating ideas and animating forces. But as the Supreme Court said in Minor v. Happersett that we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. there isn't. Citizens do not possess a right to vote. The Constitution does not say so. Nonetheless, each of these amendments, there's 4 voting amendments to the Constitution. They all start with this. Okay, so let me just rewind. So it's in the Constitution that we have a right to vote, but it's nowhere conferred upon people,
right.
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Article 2, Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So what happens here? Let's just be clear. What does this amendment do then? I said at the beginning of the podcast, but we should say it again. The right of the United States, right? Mm-hmm. shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. It wipes the word male where it still exists in all state voter qualifications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a negative.
It's a negative conferral of a right. Exactly. Yeah, we have a lot of negative rights statements in the United States, but this negative rights statement is not such that it vests people with. Otherwise, the use of literacy tests and poll taxes and understanding clauses, which are created right around the same era, would not be lawful because they would be violating that so-called right of citizens of the United States to vote.
Yeah.
Right? But they are lawful because they don't use any of the specific criteria either in the 15th or the 19th Amendment. Mm. So one might ask if that negative conferral of a right to vote here is really even a right.
Mm. Right, right.
Because there's nothing here to defend it against any other abridgment. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Poll taxes, literacy tests, understanding clauses, which exist outside the Deep South, right. they exist all across the United States in this era, will mean that people who are ensnared in that administration of those will still not be able to.
So you're reading from a facsimile, and it's printed on really nice paper here.
They're mm-hmm. really thick cardstock. They're beautifully
and
reproduced.
Some of them have like texture to them, like this is mm-hmm. like got kind of a linen-y finish, which you would think is like a, I don't know, the original document would be on such heavy stock, you know. And
it surely was not.
I'm sure it wasn't. But what do you make of these documents that this game includes? They have there's a lot of them.
Yeah,
there's
probably 12 of them over there, something like that. Maybe 15. I don't know.
There's a good number of them.
Are printed to scale. They're made to look the right, the real thing. And so, what do you make of all this additional supplemental material?
Well, I'm guided by the piece by the game designer that mm-hmm. I read before this, mm-hmm. and she said when she herself was researching this game, she was very taken with the documents themselves and mm-hmm. the beauty and the interest that they had, and so she wanted very much to include them in the game. So I think mm-hmm. it's terrific that they've done so, and I think that it's fun for game players to pick them up and take a look at them. And they're sized kind of according to the original.
Yeah, like you're holding one that's a telegram, and it's a smaller rectangle. It's like a quarter sheet.
And you can imagine this would have been the size of the actual telegram. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So this is something we see in things
in color,
like art
books,
and like I have like some special edition vinyl records that have stuff like this in it. You know, but I don't know that I've ever seen anything like this in a board game.
Certainly not to this scale.
No, not this extent.
It's really fantastic.
Yeah. This changes, for me, the interpretation of the game. And I want to just sort of ask us maybe for a second to kind of reflect on the experience of playing it as a sort of storytelling exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And because the game is sort of locked in by the eras that we have to experience, right? We have an early era, a middle era, and a late era. So mm-hmm. we sort of pass through time the same way every single time we play this game.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so the overarching structure of the story will always be the same. And I was struck by it because you were sitting here telling us so much, you know, additional information about almost every single card that came out, which was fantastic. Although I'm glad we have it on recording because I was really focused on the game. I was so excited. But
I was so distracted by the history.
But I mean, so as an educational piece, I'm wondering if you're sort of responding to it in that way.
Yeah, I think it can be. I think, you know, the game itself didn't draw any of these documents in particularly.
No, they didn't know.
But I think if anyone's playing the game, they're going to be curious about, you know, what these documents are.
You and open it the box and they're piled up on top.
Yeah.
And also, I think the more you play it, each of the cards has really interesting history on it. Mm-hmm. Like, the cards are beautifully designed. Mm-hmm. And but even like these, the state cards have really beautiful illustrations cool. down at the bottom, which are also reproducing artifacts. So there's actually artifacts all through this game. Mm-hmm. It's just that the big pieces that are standalone are these. But then there's all kinds of images and documents and broadsides and cartoons represented on the cards. And then at the bottom, like each of the cards has a name, like he played the Southern Strategy card or Susan B. Anthony indicted card. And then at the top of that card, there's also a reproduction, as you can see here, is a reproduction of the cover of the book that published the proceedings of Susan B. Anthony's trial. Yeah. The petition to Congress has an actual petition at the top of it for universal suffrage. The cards that were people had their actual pictures of them at the top.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm asking sort of is, do you think these documents and the sort of research that went into representing these things so lovingly and accurately validates it more as like a potential educational tool in some way? Does it give it more credit? You know, I'm thinking like it's just so it's so thorough, and it's like I jokingly said citation earlier, right? It's bringing in these primary sources as citation almost for like the things that we're doing in the game.
I guess I have mixed feelings about it because the documentation is rich and largely accurate, you know, and beautiful. And I really enjoyed encountering it. At the same time, there is a narrative that is built into this game and built into the materials, and the documents don't necessarily disrupt that narrative. So we might have Ida B. Wells, we might have other things. We never have suffragists who don't use that label. We never have biracial democracy across the South. We have kind of white supremacy, but we don't ever have an opposition to white supremacy in play, which there was. Many, you know, we have Mary Botnew Baldwin, we have Zitka Lassa. They're fighting multiple things, and this reduces it to a single fight. And so in that sense, none of those alternative processes that are simultaneous that people are dealing with ever come into the game. Like, the game is focused on a goal, and the goal is presumed to be good.
And you also commented
several. And it's also presumed to be the only definition of that goal, where there could have been other definitions of that goal.
You also commented several times about it fudging history a little bit, right? It kind of it shifts it in one direction or another, right? It like, because something comes out of order.
Oh, right. Yeah, right. I think that was when you started the Civil War
after the 15th Amendment.
Locked
you all out of the South and Appalachia.
Yeah, it would be nice on their early, middle, late cards also, I think I mentioned, if they included dates for some of the things.
But that's like that's like a solution to a game problem, right? Because you can't have the same cards coming out in the exact same order every single time you play the game, or else it wouldn't be fun, right?
Yep, exactly.
So
I didn't have too much trouble with the kind of timeline sequencing. It's just that, again, it was constrained down to one thing when there were multiple things going on.
It takes place within a broader landscape of historical struggle, like about all kinds of things.
Right, and none of that impinges upon this process.
Right.
Except that these ladies are sometimes racist, which of course is in some ways contradictory to the cards themselves because the ladies weren't all white. So obviously... Ida B. Wells and Mary Church Terrell and Mary Louise Botnew Baldwin were not engaging in white supremacist thinking, and where's their strategy or their vision or their struggle on this board. But because they didn't identify specifically as suffragists per se, because they had many things they were fighting, They don't show. So there's a kind of way in which this is both challenged and reified right. all at the same
right,
time.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, this is why.
And I appreciate the struggle. Yeah, I mean, it's a struggle. Sure. So.
Yeah. And you can only do so much through like a game mechanic. Right? Yeah. You have to abstract it in some way. So
that's yeah. universally arrive at yeah. that conclusion.
And that would be interesting too. I mean, I read in the game documents too, yeah. that the designer acknowledges the limitations of 1848 and 1920.
Yeah.
Kudos. Mm-hmm. But then says we have to have a game start and stop somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, you could have multiple ending points. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about game design to know exactly how that would work, but
yeah.
here there are two things that we have to accomplish. One is getting it through Congress, then getting it ratified. Yeah. What if there's kind of a third development, mm-hmm. which is, let's say it's ratified, are you or are you not now going to help it include more women?
Yeah,
or right. Is that even a choice throughout the game? Like, which mm-hmm. version of the amendment or which version of victory do you want to try to fight for? And yeah. here it's presumed to be self-evident and singular.
Yeah.
And
you don't ever have to, as the suffragist players, you don't ever have to build the movement.
No.
The movement comes pre-built.
Yeah. Well, and so does the goal, right? Right. The goal yeah. comes pre-built. And what we don't have, yeah. are we going to reverse Jim Crow, mm-hmm. Laws.
Right.
So a bunch of people just lost the vote, right? Millions of black men and millions of men of color are losing the vote in this simultaneous period. But do we get to include that as part of our struggle? Mm-hmm. It's never here, you know? And for a lot of women of color, all of that was their struggle, right? Mm-hmm. Getting the franchise restored to the men who had just lost it and getting it extended to themselves. Mm-hmm. And that vision of votes for women is not here.
Yeah. Has this game... And through the act of playing it, gotten you to think about your expertise, your field, or this topic in a new way?
Yeah, a couple of ways. And one is one that I've been mindful of ever since the centennial, which is just how difficult it is to render complex historical narratives and complex historical events with nuance when you're dealing with something other than a, 300-page monograph, which is what I get to write,
right.
or a course that lasts 15 weeks and right. I get to delve into all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. So if you're playing a game for an hour or you're at a museum exhibit and you've got, three sentences instead of one, like these cards do, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. And that is a really honestly vexing thing, that it's not kind of like, oh, people just failed. I am both really thankful that I don't have to write museum copy and I don't have to design games that represent all that complexity. Mm-hmm. And I'm in some ways an overly harsh critic in that regard, right? Because it is in the very genre to be difficult to render that complexity. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I have to say that playing this game, I was really frustrated at how much power the opposition had and how little they had to do. Mm-hmm. And so I walk away from this with a brand new appreciation for the difficulty of ratifying a federal amendment and passing a federal amendment.
Yeah.
Now,
I do
too. I'm kind of like, wow, it was stacked against us at every single turn at Jordan and I. Like, I mean, Stephen just had
it's
like...
brutal.
Yeah, and he starts with way more, more...
You play that patriarchy card, and all of a sudden there's red cubes everywhere.
All of a sudden you've got red cubes, you've got buttons, you've got... So I did appreciate that part of it. I like that it doesn't make it an even battle. I thought that was really fun. Yeah. And I think speaks to the difficulty that social movements have, just in general, of getting anything accomplished against the opposition, which is always stacked with more resources and more cultural capital. And, so I really like that about it. I thought that was really interesting. And I love the two stages of the game as well.
The ratification.
Having to get it through. And then your strategy changes in the second half of the game. So it also is sort of like playing different games all inside of one, which I also liked.
Yeah, this early part where you're sort of lobbying Congress feels a little bit more strategic. It's like I'm making decisions about whether I want to prioritize organizing versus campaigning versus lobbying. I need to build this track. The second half is just like a race. Yep. It's just like a tactical race, responding to circumstances as they emerge, just trying to get those, as many states as
you can. It's like running a campaign.
Yeah. So
this has been a pleasure.
Such a wonderful time. Yeah.
Thank you so much. For joining us and playing this game with us.
Thank you for being, for inviting me and letting me do this incredibly interesting and novel and inventive way of approaching this topic. It was super fun.
Okay, wow, what a game session.
Yeah, it was great. It was pretty intense. It was maybe the most I've cared about the outcome of the game ever for the show.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think I've ever really been invested like on a like a an like a personal player way. This game sets up a competitive atmosphere of opposition.
Yeah, you were tugging on that beard.
Oh, I was really invested. Yeah, I was really invested in trying to figure out, which is a shame because I was playing as the opposition. I was really invested in figuring out a way to squash the 19th Amendment. Yeah. And ultimately, I just by the skin of my teeth did.
Yeah. But, with a lucky dice roll.
But I mean, from your perspective, I mean, similarly, right? That's an interesting flip side that you were just like super engaged and invested in this fight for women's suffrage. And the game enabled you to experience that in a way that was like obviously historically removed and vicarious in more ways than one, right? Since you identify as male.
This connects very well to my meaningful moment.
Okay, great. So we'll kick it off. Take us in.
So my meaningful moment was straight up losing as the suffrage movement. And I often say this to you, to anybody who will listen to me talk about like winning and losing in games, that I don't mind losing. Like I actually kind of like it in games that I'm engaged with. Like if I feel like it's close and fair and exciting, I actually kind of love losing because it makes me want to play again.
Yeah.
Yeah. It makes me want to like, ooh, I could do something slightly
A game that you can play and lose and enjoy is a good game.
So that's right? not unique about this game because I like that about pretty much every game that that has a good close win or lose condition at the end. But for me, what set it over the edge was it being connected to this very important political movement and that communicating a very powerful message about, as Lisa said, it is really hard to do something like this.
Yeah.
And
again, the odds are stacked against. So like the democratic process is asymmetrical basically. Absolutely. Right. And this game models that really well in ways that are very viscerally felt by the players on the suffragist side.
Yeah.
And it feels super unfair cause it is
for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, it felt like it's communicating a very powerful message about the fight needing to continue. And that was really hammered home by losing again, even though I feel like we had a shot.
You were so close.
We were very, very close.
I was worried.
and this, the suffrage movement just barely lost. And and I kind of like this idea of it being like, well, if I play again and I win as a suffrage player, I will be like over the moon because finally...
Yeah.
The justice will have been served and the thing will have been done and it's amazing and now the world is a better place.
It's just so hard to pass to ratify an amendment. Yeah. That's what your comment like highlights for me is this game is just like, wow, how did any amendments ever get ratified? Is kind of what it makes me think.
That's right.
Because it's just incredible. It's like you took every state in the Northeast region. You had almost every state in the Midwest. There was one left. You would have gotten it eventually. Mm-hmm. You took every state in the Plains. We split Appalachia. And we were in the process of splitting the West. You had only one state in the South. I had every other state. Mm-hmm. And you lost.
Yeah.
Like, all I had to do was take almost all of the Southern states, mm-hmm. split Appalachia with you, and get three Western states. Yeah, it was over.
Yeah. And it all ended in Utah. So, there you go.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is incredible.
Yeah. What about you?
My meaningful moment had to do with the area of the board which changes game conditions, either permanently or for the turn or for final voting. And mostly these have to do with the permanent ones. Mm-hmm. Because as we were having the discussion while playing with Lisa beforehand, she was mentioning the way in which like the 15th Amendment was so important for the women's suffrage movement because it framed the struggle around constitutional amendments. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, who can vote and what a voter is. That's constitutionally litigated. Mm-hmm. So if we want to change our access to the political process through voting, we need to fight for an amendment, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a bunch of cards that you can only play if the 15th Amendment has been passed. It changes the political landscape in a particular way. Mm-hmm. But that's not my meaningful moment. My meaningful moment has to do with the opposition because I was the opposition. So there's also a card which the suffragists have called the Southern Strategy, which if you play it, changes conditions for the rest of the game. It's one of those permanent effect cards. And I forget exactly what it did for you. I think what it did was it cut back my tide in the South, right? Yep. It eliminated a bunch of my cubes in the South. Yep. It didn't get you anything. You only actually, well, it didn't give you nothing. You got Arkansas, right? Mm-hmm. But you didn't win any other states in the southern region as a result of that card. But what it did do is it opened up a bunch of cards in my hand that I kept seeing late on that I could only play because you had played the southern strategy. So as Lisa, I'll try and keep this brief, but as Lisa explained to us when we were playing, the southern strategy was basically a way of appealing to the white supremacist southern legislators that it would be good for them to give white women the vote because it would help mitigate the democratic gains that black people and people of color had made as a result of the 15th Amendment. So it was like a way of offsetting and disenfranchising black voters by, like, quote unquote, like diluting the voter pool with more white votes, right? So pretty heinous strategy for suffragists to pursue.
I think I used the words gross.
Yeah, right. So, but in the moment, right, it was important that, like, to stop me from having just like a critical mass of states like all across the South. So you played it, but it opened the door for me later to play cards like the one which I pulled out here. This is a very long-winded, meaningful moment. The one that I pulled out here is white supremacy and the suffrage movement, which I could only play because you all had played the Southern strategy. And it allowed me to remove all of the yellow cubes in up to 4 states. And then you guys lost some buttons. I think this won me the game, actually.
Yeah, probably. Because
it created just, wreaked just enough havoc and set you all back just enough that you had to rebuild what I had wiped out with this card, which bought me just enough time to get to 13.
You did take a big chunk out of our strategy at that point in time. Yeah, that was good.
So that to me is just meaningful because it speaks to the way in which these political compromises have really long-term harmful effects.
Yeah.
Potentially. Now, in the course of history, the 19th Amendment did get ratified, but that was a very risky strategy.
Sure.
That certainly divided the movement, certainly harmful to the movement. In the end, it did not kill it in the way that it did in this game for us. But yeah.
So, what about your unexpected expertise?
Oh, man,
Can we just take a moment and say that Lisa was a font of knowledge very willing to share
so much amazing expertise. Amazing. I just feel like I attended like a flash course in history of democracy.
Yeah. So it is hard to choose.
Yeah. So there was so much expertise. It was great. We were so lucky to be joined by her and play this game alongside her. I picked one thing. Let me remind myself what I was. I mean, I do want to give a shout out to, and this is a sort of follow on from what I was just saying. She was relating some stories about like confrontations, actual confrontations between, big, leaders, historical leaders of the movement, like, Stanton and Anthony and figures like Frederick Douglass in the Northeast, where there was like these really kind of awful clashes around race. And so you sort of assume, right, that any movement that's located in like the mid to late 19th century is going to be engaged in racist discourse in some ways that are probably uncomfortable or surprising. But I was not quite prepared to be confronted with the strident racism that was like being thrown around in some of these spaces. But that's, so I just want to sort of like acknowledge that and point that out, because I don't know how much we'll be able to fit in from all the stuff she was sharing. But my unexpected expertise actually has to do more with constitutional law and how she was relating the fact that the 19th Amendment and the 15th Amendment sort of enumerate certain rights based on a presumed category of the voter. But that, in fact, the category of the voter is never enumerated anywhere in the Constitution.
Yeah.
So never, it kind of just stated. Assumes this position and this subject position for citizens, but never lays out in states what it is, which is why at the state level that has been laid out. And so then in many and most states, it was laid out as men, right? It was laid out as male or male and white, et cetera, right? So I just thought that was fascinating. I didn't know that.
And my unexpected expertise is very similar, because I didn't want to get too specific because there was so much there. And I think it was sort of like the evolution of voters' rights, starting with the sort of us talking about the 15th Amendment and then later ones that then lead to the 18th. And she said, I believe there's 4, like voting specific amendments to the Constitution.
So 18 is prohibition. And then 19 is this one, obviously. And then 20 is repealing prohibition. But then in the early 20s after that, like 21, the early 20s amendments, not the early 1920s, but the early 20s of the amendments, like 21, 22, 23, I think 24 might have to do with voting rights. There are a few more that come out later.
And I think that just the evolution and hearing her talk about how, you know, starting again with the 15th in this case, it's sort of setting a precedent for the way the next amendments sort of also address this issue. And that it kind of leading straight to the very weird stuff that's going on with voting rights today and and how it basically puts the power in the federal, you know, in the hands of the federal government to really control the way that states administer voting rights. Mm-hmm. And that is, in many cases, a good thing probably, right? Because, yeah. you know, we get, as we see every 4 years, sort of like a miserable display of different states interpreting
yeah.
how to administer, yeah. you know, voting privileges to different communities yeah, and things like that.
New creative right? strategies for disenfranchising.
And that to me, it just got yeah. me thinking a lot about yeah. how complicated it is and how we take a lot of things for granted when it comes to voting. Mm-hmm, and it's all based on these little sheets of paper with very few words on them. And and our ability to interpret what that is. So subject matter score.
Yeah. Okay.
This is a good one. So let's
do a little drum roll or maybe not.
We do the 3-2-1.
Yeah. 3-2-1 and then we'll reveal at the same time.
Yes.
Okay. Everybody's on the same page now.
We got it. Right. We got it.
Strap right. yourselves in. All right.
Three, two, one.
7.5.
Very close. We're okay. always so close, actually. Close. Yeah, you know.
So why don't you talk about the 7, and then sure. I'll argue for my half point.
Okay. Yeah. I'll start with why I took it down a couple of ticks, because I think lobbying is very abstracted. The lobbying yeah. to Congress really just involves playing a card or rolling a die, and a column appears or disappears.
All three of those core alternative card actions are really abstracted.
Yeah.
Like organizing, you just like burn a card and you get some buttons.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, is that what it's like to organize a movement? You know? The three core actions, the three core actions that are not the historical event actions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also am not crazy about die in general. I like a card more than a die. You know, it just feels like a lot of effort goes into something, to strategizing something that it can just like go completely haywire based on a really good or bad die roll. And that's sort of very minor details, because I think that these are sort of like ancillary systems to the core system, which mm-hmm. is dealing with this map that we have in front of us. Mm-hmm. And the map is, for me, very tight, very exciting, particularly in this playthrough. The mm-hmm. first one was less so, but this one, right, I mean, I was standing and looking.
Yeah, by the end of it, we were all kind of standing up, like, yeah, which is always a good sign.
Pacing around a little bit, trying to mm-hmm. figure out, mm-hmm. you know, like, and it felt like I was in sort of like a campaign room mm-hmm. with a map on the wall.
Updating the victory map. Yep,
and shuffling pieces around and thinking about, well, okay, if he goes there, then I'll go there. And, you know, like it mm-hmm. just, and it felt like, you know, we're traveling around the country, making phone calls to people saying, hey, can we get you to go down there and like meet these people, you know, do this kind of stuff. That was really communicated very nicely to me in this playthrough.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, I think I've already said, I think you're spot on this point that lobbying is maybe the most egregious example, or maybe actually I think organizing is probably the most egregious example of the three. You know, campaigning is a little less so. You can only campaign to the extent you have campaigners. Mm-hmm. And so that determines how much sentiment you can generate, and you can only place it based on how distributed your network is nationally. So that stuff makes a little bit more sense. Mm-hmm. The dice thing is an interesting question. You know, I have kind of mixed feelings about dice in history games, especially. Mm-hmm. I think that they're important, actually, because history is always poised around uncertainty, and you mm-hmm. don't, you know, to some extent. But what I think can often happen, which is problematic, is it can often give an all too seductive impression that, like, the tide of history and the turn of events is mm-hmm. like dumb luck or something. Mm-hmm. And so when in fact that belies like the presence of really ingrained and deep seated structural systems, which determine the range of outcomes mm-hmm. That are available to people, you know? So I think that what I like about this game is that at least the opposition models that like structural inequity and like constraint in a particular way. Mm-hmm. So that the dice rolling felt actually like it was working in the suffragist's favor, not mine.
For sure.
Which is good, I think, right? Because it's like, well, if we get lucky,
even though you won, enough, you know, like,
yeah, but if we're plucky enough and if we pound away at this and we take our chance, maybe we'll roll some sixes, right? Yeah. And so if you can do that, that I think works a little bit better than sometimes in history games, the dice can be like, oh, okay. Well, you know. So yeah, I will say that. It's just something your comment made me think about. It is a nub in history games. And it's like interesting, like to dice or not dice and how many dice. And yeah. I gave it a 7.5, like not higher than that. I think basically for me, similar to your comments, I feel like compelled to justify why I didn't give this an even higher score, yeah, rather than saying why it is as high as 7.5, which is higher than a lot of the games that we've looked at and played with experts. And I think there's really two things that come to mind. One has to do with the historical documents. And this was something that Lisa spoke about a little bit. The historical documents that come with the game are amazing. There are all these like spectacular historical supplements, these like really faithfully recreated facsimile telegrams and letters and things like this. And, you know, like sample ballots and all kinds of stuff. They're so amazing that I just can't help but be a little disappointed that there's really no set purpose for them.
Yeah.
That I could literally, as a player, I could open this up, I could look at them, disregard them, set them aside, and never look at them again.
Yeah.
And I could play the game 12 billion times and never have to look at them. Mm-hmm. Of course, who's going to do that? But like at the same time, I really wish that they had been incorporated in some way, you know, even if it's just to say, like, if we play a card, you have to go find this document, read it out to the table, and then you resolve the card, right? Like, just bring it over into this space and make us interact with it.
To me, it sort of stands in as like a game that has sort of obscenely large plastic figurines.
Yeah, yeah, it's like the history game equivalent of like a giant mini.
Yeah,
yeah, it's like, hey, check out this facsimile telegram. Yeah.
Totally unnecessary to the gameplay, but adds a lot of flavor.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, I think they're great. I think every history game should include stuff like this. I mean, the cards and all the components have a really rich sense of like primary artifact imbued in them, which is really cool. And the game is beautifully made. So, but it did bother me that like they had done all of that and there wasn't just like some effort made, even to just, like I said, like having the players, forcing the players to read it. Because of course, then they could just not. But like, at least it's written into the game's system that you, when you play a certain card, you have to go look at a document, right? So I think that was one thing. And that's a minor thing. The more substantial thing that I think keeps this below like an 8 or 8.5 for me, which it otherwise seems kind of nailed on to be, is directly related to sort of like playing it with Lisa. And I don't know if I would have had this impression if we hadn't. And this has to do with the way in which the game, for everything that it does really well and really effectively, which is plenty, it fails to produce a very rich sense of like a social topography of struggle and instead provides a very stark sense of like the political geography of struggle. So if I could like maybe unpack that a little bit, it gives you a sense of like geography, like it maps the borders and the boundaries of states and institutions very clearly.
And that is absolutely spot on.
Right?
Like in both plays we had, like looking at the map, through the act of play, we basically recreated the states that would have voted for and against this right to vote, right? That is impressive.
Yeah.
That's really...
It does that very well.
And
the sort of sense of enmity and high stakes uncertainty that it creates as you're racing to ratify is also really well done and well communicated. But, you know, it doesn't give you... So it gives you that geography of ratification very well. But by topography, I mean more like mapping not just the boundaries and limits of institutions and states, but really the features on the ground, the features and fissures of political sentiment and alliance and struggle that may or may not have anything to do directly with this amendment or this question of whether or not to vote yes or no on this, right? It sort of doesn't manage to convey a rich sense of like the way in which any movement, any decision, any vote is always mired within like a much broader and much more complex set of political affiliations, political views, attitudes, beliefs, movements, struggles, etc. And like, I don't know, I don't mean this as a knock on the game. I think the game's design would have to be so much heavier to include that, right? And it's
way
nice
bigger.
That it's not heavy because we can actually learn it really quickly and play it really well.
Yeah, it's very elegant design.
Yeah, so it's nice that it's not overly heavy in that way. You would have to include some element of like, I don't know, tableau building or deck building before you could even start drawing your hand that would help you try and, you know, approximate. You would need basically like four times as many cards and then like a whole other system of generating a deck for each movement, right?
But that struck me actually quite a bit when the Civil War happened.
Yeah,
right. Like there, like nothing's really different. I mean, there's like one tiny little thing that happens for one turn, and then it's done, right? Yeah. I mean, I guess it is kind of the big thing is that you just can't place pieces in either the South or Atlantic or Appalachia. I mean, I guess that is a pretty good abstraction, but it doesn't feel like there's not a lot of meat there.
Well, and it's an end of turn effect. It's not a forever effect.
Yeah.
but like the Civil War definitely changed the landscape of American politics forever
yeah.
in real ways, which are represented by the other forever effect cards, like the 15th Amendment, which is only mm-hmm. a, you know, this kind of makes sense, right? But like, it just felt a little bit, yeah, it felt like, it just felt like, oh, okay, we've made a decision to like make this game a certain kind of weight. And that's an important decision. And I don't think it's the wrong one. I don't think they made the wrong call. Like the game works really well as a game.
Yeah, it's,
but when you play it with somebody like Lisa, who knows like an insane amount of historical detail and depth of knowledge about this topic, she was really able to draw out for us like, well, hey, it's really cool that like this figure's in this deck, but this figure maybe not, wouldn't have identified primarily as a suffragist.
Right.
Right. This is just a political activist who happens to be a woman mm-hmm. and they're an indigenous woman. So like their struggle is embroiled within all of these other things having to do with statehood in like the Plains region mm-hmm. and like new mm-hmm. states joining the union and questions about tribal sovereignty and yeah. citizenship and whether or not this is even, you know, it's like, that's a rich topography yeah. of struggle in that zone that the game's just not really capable to give players. And that's not, you know, it's not like a failing necessarily, but it is just a reality of design. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this, we're always going to score these games that take on very sprawling subject matter a little lower
yeah.
than games that have a really specific topic,
yeah.
right?
Right.
It's happened time and time again.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it also has to do with like the way this game was framed for us from the get-go because of who we played it with, right? Mm-hmm. So we played it with an expert whose research has largely been committed to like reframing mm-hmm. one small, very focused thing, the 19th Amendment, within a larger history of struggle, a larger sort of a richer sense of like political movements generally and democracy in the United States, constitutional law. So yeah, I mean, obviously we framed it that way and then it kind of it falls short in certain areas. If we approach this game differently, it's just like, hey, the ratification of the 19th Amendment, it would be, it's pretty faithful to like just that
9.5.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. So, I mean, that might've been their intention, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, but it is interesting. It's like, you know, you have to make those decisions about, well, but you can't understand the ratification of the 19th Amendment if you don't understand like the 19th Amendment within a bit more broader terms, right? Or something like that. Yeah. So interesting questions to consider.
It's been a wonderful pleasure game to play.
I'm glad it exists. And, I'm super glad it exists. It's a great game.
I'll play it again.
Yeah,
absolutely. And, great work, Tori and Kevin, for making this a reality. And Steve, thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure. Always a pleasure.
And until next time,
we'll see you around the table.
Bye.